Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 1st of June. Our main stories: Syrian activists say President Assad's latest offensive has led to the biggest wave of displaced people since the civil war began. The Kosovan Prime Minister orders the expulsion of a Russian UN official accused of obstructing the police. And the US says it may not pass on intelligence to allies who use Huawei in their 5G networks. Also in this podcast:
the largest numbers come from Israel, and the second largest community that applied is the Turkish community. And number three is Brazil.
Why thousands of people want to become Portuguese. 8 years into the Syrian civil war, President Assad's forces backed by Russia have intensified their assaults on the last rebel-held province. The fighting in Idlib has led to what humanitarian organisations describe as the biggest wave of displaced people since the conflict began. Hundreds of thousands have fled towards Turkey, but the border is closed, so they're living in desperate conditions. At a news conference in Istanbul, activists criticised the lack of action from the international community. Mohamed Zahed Al-Masri is a spokesman for the Alliance of Syrian NGOs.
The entire world is watching the massacre that's taking place and letting it pass in silence. It's also ignoring violations of human rights and international law. The United Nations hasn't even lifted its little finger.
Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, told me about conditions in Idlib.
Well, the latest figure given today to mark a month of this offensive, which is Syrian government forces backed as ever by Russian air power, which has been attacking the northwest of Hama province and the edge of Idlib province for weeks on a daily basis, says that more than 300,000 people have been displaced. The UN was giving a slightly lower figure a few days ago. The casualties, again, from Syrian activists saying that almost 950 people have been killed. Now, most of those are people who were involved in the fighting on either side, but hundreds of civilians, around 300, they say, have also been killed, of which a number of them are children. Again, that's a slightly higher figure than we're getting from the UN. But there's no doubt that this has been a major escalation. And this is in the area where back last September, there was a major effort made by Russia and by Turkey, who pull strings with different sides, to calm down a situation so such an offensive wouldn't take place. But in a sense, it's always been on the cards ever since. What we're not clear about yet is how far the ambitions of the Syrian government go with this. I mean, they want to regain full control of the two main highways in the country, whether they actually want to take the whole of Idlib back. And this is the beginning of that offensive, we still can't gauge.
At the same time, we've also seen controversy today over casualty figures released by the US-led coalition that's been taking action in Syria.
Yes, I mean, it's controversy just simply over what the figures are that the UN-led coalition is admitting to in terms of civilian deaths. Now, this is since, I think it was August 2014, when the campaign against ISIS was launched by President Obama, going right through to April of this year, when the last remnants in Syria were essentially defeated. Now, the figures that were given by the US-led coalition say that they have unintentionally killed just over 1,300 civilians during that time, with over 34,000 airstrikes. Now, that is a huge difference from figures given by other independent monitors. I mean, one, Air Wars, says that the figure may be, at the lowest level, 8,000 up to 12,000. When you look at the devastation wreaked in Raqqa and Mosul, you can believe that.
Sebastian Usher. Relations between Kosovo and Serbia have never been easy, but they seem particularly bad at the moment. On Thursday, Kosovo banned the Serbian Prime Minister from entering the country. Now it's ordered the expulsion of a UN worker of Russian origin who was arrested on Tuesday for allegedly obstructing police in ethnic Serb areas of North Kosovo. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay told me more.
The Kosovo authorities allege that this particular person was involved in roadblocks which were set up by ethnic Serb people living in North Kosovo to try to prevent the Kosovo police carrying out arrests during an operation on Tuesday. And these arrests were, according to the Kosovo authorities, targeting people involved in a smuggling ring, many of them police officers. It was noted by Serbia and by ethnic Serbs living in Kosovo that most of those targeted were ethnic Serbs, and they'd tried to stop the Kosovo police carrying out their operation. And according to the authorities in Pristina, this particular Russian UN worker stopped his car on the road to try and block the police and was involved with organising people to cause a blockade.
And what's been the Russian response?
They've really not been happy, as you can imagine. The Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, has called the expulsion a very serious issue. He's also said that what we're seeing at the moment is Pristina enjoying a feeling of impunity because of Western sponsorship. So you can tell here there's a little bit of proxy going on, because, of course, Serbia is an ally of Russia. The United States is undoubtedly the biggest international supporter of Kosovo. Russia doesn't recognise Kosovo's independence, as its official press service makes clear. It always refers to it as unrecognised Kosovo. So you can tell there's a bit of proxy going on here between Russia and the United States. Serbia and Kosovo, very much the meat in the sandwich.
And does Russia have a practical impact inside Kosovo and Serbia?
In terms of its actual physical presence, it's never that great. If you look at the relations between Serbia and Russia, on Serbia's side, it's as much sentimental as anything. It acknowledges that its direction of travel is towards the European Union, that it wants to be involved looking west. But because it's an Orthodox Christian country, because it has these traditional Slavic ties with Russia, it wants to maintain that.
Guy Delaunay, our Balkans correspondent. For months, America has been pressurizing its allies to exclude Huawei from key technology networks. Now the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has warned that Washington may not pass on intelligence to countries that use the Chinese firm in their 5G networks. The US fears the Chinese government will be able to use Huawei to access sensitive information, a claim Huawei rejects. There are growing signs that President Trump will raise the issue when he visits the UK next week. Barbara Plett-Usher reports from Washington.
This is something that extends beyond a trade war with China. The dispute over 5G could affect security cooperation between the U.S. and the U.K. President Trump is expected to raise the issue during his visit next week, warning that he's prepared to limit intelligence sharing if Britain allows Huawei to build part of its 5G network. His Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has already talked about the risk of allies doing business with a Chinese company in a speech in London earlier this month. In Germany today, he did so again.
We can't permit private citizen data from the United States or national security data from the United States to go across networks that we don't have confidence, that we don't view as trusted networks.
5G is the new frontier of digital technology. It was launched in the UK yesterday in six cities. It offers much faster data speeds and will become the foundation of many mobile networks. Huawei is at the forefront of this digital revolution, but the Americans insist that's a security threat because the system could be used as a vehicle for Chinese spying. Britain is moving towards letting Huawei build certain parts of its network, non-core elements such as transmission equipment, rather than information infrastructure. But Mr. Trump's national security adviser John Bolton said yesterday the U.S. did not believe it was possible to neatly divide 5G networks into core and non-core components. He said Washington would accept zero risk.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Since the Brexit referendum 3 years ago, many British citizens have been looking to get another passport from a different EU country. Some British Jews have been applying for Portuguese citizenship, which they're entitled to if they can prove their ancestors fled the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisitions. Portugal passed a citizenship law 4 years ago as an act of atonement. Our global affairs correspondent Naomi Grimley has been talking to some of those involved.
I'm on Lisbon's sunny waterfront, and in the afternoon sunshine, when the waves are lapping at the shore and the boats are chugging up and down the River Tejo, it's easy to forget that this was a point where many Jewish families faced a terrible choice at the end of the 15th century and the beginning of the 16th century. They either had to convert to Catholicism or they had to leave from this port and head further afield to a life in exile. So some, for example, went to Amsterdam, others went to Constantinople, others again went to live in Morocco, in North Africa. And that's why Sephardic communities exist in pockets right around the world.
OK, so this is called a ketubah. It's a Jewish marriage certificate.
Generations ago, Alex Abraham's family fled the Iberian Peninsula because of religious persecution and settled instead in Salonika, part of the Ottoman Empire, which later became Greece. On the eve of the First World War, his great-grandparents moved to London. And that's why Alex is now entitled to apply for citizenship in Portugal, even though he's only been there twice.
I thought, wow, that's amazing. So I'm half Sephardi on my mother's side. I thought I'd take up the opportunity. I can remember my grandpa always talking to me about remember that we are these type of Jews. And my grandparents used to cook something called bimuelos, which are donuts made out of matzah meal. They're all right if you put honey on them. But, you know, these things that have been handed down, the identity aspect's very important to me.
This is a Portuguese Jewish prayer sung after meals, which has survived in Sephardic diasporas all across the world, from Rio to Amsterdam, from London to Rabat. People from more than 60 countries have been applying for Portuguese citizenship since 2015, when the law took effect.
When we have the power to repair an injustice, we should do that.
Maria de Belém Rosara was the politician who proposed the law on Sephardic Jews. She believes it has relevance for Portugal's place in the modern world.
We cannot sign international documents about human rights, about tolerance, equal dignity of all human beings, and then persecute people because of their beliefs. So if we are in a political field and in political activity, we should give the right signs. We should approve the right laws.
I'm inside the Oni Synagogue in Lisbon. It's a very beautiful building, elegant. At the front, you have the ark containing the scrolls. Above that, lovely mosaics. And above that, an inscription in Hebrew that reads, "Know before whom you stand." Now, this synagogue was actually built in 1902 by Moroccan Jews who'd come back to Portugal. Their families had originally been expelled by the Inquisition. So this building, if you like, is a symbol of how many Sephardic Jews have kept Portugal in their hearts, even in exile.
Five commandments, so there are 10 commandments altogether.
Gabriel Steinhardt is president of Lisbon's small Jewish community. The synagogue has been helping the government navigate which applicants have genuine Sephardic roots. He told me about 30,000 people have applied so far, a quarter of whom have been successful.
The largest numbers come from Israel, and the second largest community that applied is the Turkish community. And number three is Brazil.
Some applicants can prove their roots easily through family names and synagogue records. Others have sent in photos of old gravestones and recordings of songs sung by grandparents in a Sephardic language called Ladino. Gabriel has also heard about one extraordinary form of proof.
I know personally of at least two cases of Jews, one from Istanbul and the other one from Smyrna, that have kept keys of their homes in Portugal and transmitted them from generation to generation. Obviously, these houses do not exist anymore, nor do the people know where those houses are. But anyway, it's a very moving story.
But the locks have been changed.
Probably.
Back in London, Alex is waiting for the email or letter that tells him all the paperwork has been completed. When you get your passport, what will you do to celebrate becoming Portuguese, as well as British, of course?
I would definitely go there again with my wife and kids, and I will properly invest in a language teacher.
That report by Naomi Grimley. And still to come in the podcast.
In our country right now, it's like war and a lot of bad news every day. So the one thing which Afghan pupils follow always is cricket. So it means a lot for our country.
Why Afghans are hoping the Cricket World Cup will unite their nation. The WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is the victim of psychological torture, according to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. Professor Nils Meltzer said the controversial campaigner shouldn't be extradited to the US, as he would have no chance of a fair trial. Mr. Meltzer visited Julian Assange 3 weeks ago in prison in London, where he's serving a 50-week sentence for skipping bail in 2012. Our diplomatic correspondent James Robbins reports.
There's little doubt Julian Assange is not well. He's on the hospital wing at Belmarsh Prison, but he's apparently eating normally. The question is what caused his condition. Under the auspices of the UN Human Rights Council, Nils Meltzer, who's described as an outside expert and not a member of UN staff, saw Assange with two medical experts on a confidential prison visit 3 weeks ago. In his capacity as Special Rapporteur on Torture, Mr. Meltzer has now reported that
we could see that Mr. Assange showed all symptoms that are typical for prolonged exposure to psychological torture. His current state is critical. He urgently needs access to a psychiatrist that is not part of the prison service. I've worked in many areas of war in my life. What I have never seen is that a single person has been deliberately isolated, and I would say persecuted, not prosecuted, but persecuted by several democratic states in a concerted effort to eventually break his will.
But the Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, has dismissed the findings as wrong. In a message on social media, Mr. Hunt says, Assange chose to hide in the Ecuadorian embassy and was always free to leave and face justice. The UN Special Rapporteur should allow British courts to make their judgment without his interference or inflammatory accusations. Previously, British governments have sometimes sided with other special UN rapporteurs, highlighting human rights abuses by, for instance, Syria's President Assad. This time, the government is convinced a part of the UN system has failed.
James Robbins. Earlier this month, the BBC announced it had commissioned a two-part drama inspired by the 2018 Novichok poisonings in the southern English city of Salisbury. Now, the parents of a police officer who fell ill during the investigation have criticised the plans, saying they sensationalise what happened. Farhana Darwood reports.
In March last year, the quiet, scenic city of Salisbury became the centre of a poisoning mystery. Five people were made very ill by a toxic nerve agent and one of them died. The target of the attack was a former Russian spy, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter. Detective Sergeant Nick Bailey was contaminated with Novichok when he was sent to examine their home.
I was very, very unsteady on my feet. The sweating had gone from my forehead down my back. My whole body was just dripping with sweat. Such a dangerous thing to have in your system. I have passing moments where I think about how it could affect me. But I can't control that. It's happened now.
Nick Bailey's parents have said it's disappointing that the BBC intends to produce a dramatisation. They said the creative team's promise to focus on the heroism with which ordinary people reacted to the crisis is an excuse to sensationalise an episode which is still very raw. Mr. and Mrs. Bailey feel that a documentary produced by the BBC on the subject late last year was sufficient. The local police are supporting the production, but the people of Salisbury appear divided. Many just want to put the whole incident behind them. Others are happy about the money the filming could bring in and suggest by the time the drama airs, the people of Salisbury will be ready.
Farhana Darwood. Later today, Liverpool will take on Tottenham Hotspur in Madrid in one of the most prestigious games in world football, the Champions League final. It's the first all-English final since Manchester United beat Chelsea in 2008, and thousands of football fans have arrived in the Spanish capital ahead of the match. Our correspondent Gavin Lee has been to meet some of them.
Madrid's main square here at Plaza Mayor is already packed. With thousands of fans on the streets in the sunshine, the red shirts of the Liverpool fans are more visible at the moment. Some are wearing Egyptian hats featuring snakes and pharaohs in honour of their star player and the Egyptian national Mo Salah. Liverpool have been here before, 8 times in the final, 5 times champions. For Tottenham, this will be the first Champions League trophy, and both sets of fans have travelled far to be here.
I've travelled from Dubai to get here. We booked our flights before we'd even made it. We lost 3-0 to Barcelona and contemplated cancelling our flights, but said, hang on, let's just wait, let's just wait.
I can't explain how excited I am. I'm over the moon. I can't wait for tomorrow.
I just had a feeling that we were going to make the Champions League final, so I thought, you know what, why not just book a holiday in Spain, just start from Barcelona and then go to Madrid.
Spanish authorities say this is the biggest surveillance operation that police have carried out at any sporting event in Spain, with almost 5,000 officers patrolling the streets and deploying drones for the first time to monitor from above, equipped to disable other drones. English football fans travelling abroad come with a reputation for trouble, though Spanish police say they have no specific reason for concern this weekend. 90,000 fans are expected, 20,000 fans will be here without tickets, and many wanting to soak up the atmosphere on the night. It's also an event that's predicted to bring £60 million worth of trade to the Spanish capital, with hotels, B&Bs and even campsites completely full, for the spectacle of European football's biggest prize.
Gavin Lee. Staying with sport, the Cricket World Cup, which began in England on Thursday, features the game's top 10 cricketing nations, among them Afghanistan, even though the national team there was only formed in 2001. The sport is hugely popular among Afghans, and millions will be following the side's first World Cup match against Australia on Saturday. Our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick has been talking to Afghan players and fans here for the tournament.
Just 10 teams at this World Cup. That's a reduction from the last time in 2015. The lowest ranked is Afghanistan, and I'm watching them practice their batting and practice their bowling ahead of their opening match against Australia. It's been an incredible journey for Afghanistan cricket ever since players first started learning the game in the refugee camps just over the border in Pakistan. The squad is now full of experience with genuine ambitions of springing one or two surprises at this tournament. I've been talking to some of their players, including the batsman Hashmatullah Shahidi.
As you see from last couple of years, we performing very well, we playing a good cricket, so it's not now the time that people say that it's a proud moment that Afghanistan team is participating in the World Cup. It's that time is gone now. We are here to win, and we are ready for it.
Just give us an idea of how important it is for this team, for Afghanistan, to have a team at the World Cup.
Very important, you know, about our country right now. It's like war and a lot of bad news every day. So the one thing which Afghan pupils follow always is cricket. So it means a lot for our country to be part of this World Cup in the big event. And our pupils expecting more from us.
And the pavements outside the Oval cricket ground earlier this week were filled with Afghani supporters queuing up for tickets ahead of a warm-up match against England, relishing the opportunity to watch their team perform on such a big stage.
We are playing the World Cup in cricket, which is unbelievable. And we are very, very proud of those boys that are playing and performing very well.
Cricket is nowadays a very famous game in Afghanistan, and it's most of the people like support the team. We have other sports as well. We are doing well, but not like cricket. The main reason is that the cricket players and is the unity they're showing, and which is a good example for other people as well.
100% they can qualify for semi-final. 100%.
And they hope there's lots to cheer about over the next 6 weeks or so, although reaching the semi-finals is probably a bit beyond them. I also met up with Afghanistan's captain, Gulbuddin Naib.
One thing in the other team didn't have, I see in my team, it's only one thing, is unity. This is the main thing in our team. And also, we have all have a passion to do for our country. So if you look our country last 40 to 45 years, there's nothing. So we're giving small things to our people.
And you're the standard bearers. Are there a new generation ready to step into your shoes once you finish?
Yes, sure. Like if you go anywhere in Afghanistan, every part of Afghanistan, all of provinces, they just craze of cricket there. We have a talent. We have a talent, a lot of talent in Afghanistan, in every part.
How far do you think Afghanistan can go here? What are the ambitions of the team?
I know what you did last 8-9 months. If we do 100% the ground, so maybe the result will be positive.
The Afghan cricket captain, Gulbuddin Naib, ending that report by Alex Capstick. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Real Protection means a home security system that's designed for you and your family. With 24/7 monitoring from 18,000 employees and connection to first responders, your property and the ones you love can feel safe and secure. ADT is great for every lifestyle. Whether you're at home or on the go, you can control everything from the ADT app or just with the sound of your voice. Visit ADT.com/podcast to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home for you and your family.